ever is rather stunningly secular, really. My starting point is that climate change is an issue quite different to any other one we've ever had to face before in human history. And the reasons for this are the following. No other civilization has ever been able to intervene into nature in the way in which our civilization does, and on a routine and everyday basis. You can say that with the advent of global industrial civilization, nature in a certain sense has ceased to exist because it's been so thoroughly penetrated by human activity and human technology. Since no other civilization was remotely close to this, it follows, to my mind anyway, we can't learn a great deal from past history in addressing an issue which concerns so strongly our future on this earth. We can't learn an awful lot from past history in coping with it. Second, climate change is extremely unusual, unique, I think, because it's a problem of truly global scope, but it's a problem which is filtered wholly through the findings of science. I don't think there's any other issue of that scope and magnitude which is filtered through the findings of science, even though science and technology, of course, do enter into so many aspects of our lives. Since it is filtered through scientific findings, it has an interesting kind of political form because, by definition, most people cannot master the scientific knowledge on which our projections about the future and our policies about the future have to depend. Even someone like me, who spent the last 2 years immersed in the climate science literature, I'm not a climatologist, and I will never be a climatologist. I spent 2 years doing it, but I still feel I struggle to master the scientific knowledge. If that's true for me, imagine what it's like for a member of the lay public who simply has no way, really, of deciding with the right kind of evidence what position to take. And it's not surprising, therefore, there is a tremendous swirl of controversy in public opinion across the world about climate change and the risks which it poses for us. Thirdly, climate change is different from other issues we've had to face because it's about largely future risk. You can make a case for saying that climate change is happening in the here and now, and I will make that case, but the damage it will do, it gets worse as the future unfolds. This means for most ordinary people, most of the lay public, and we have a lot of evidence on this, climate change is quite remote from their ordinary everyday affairs. It's not a risk which is visible in the sense in which the financial crisis is visible. We've just this year has been the hottest year in measured human history since the Industrial Revolution. We've had fires in Russia. We've had terrible floods in Pakistan. We've had abnormal weather patterns in the United States. We've had mudslides in China. Those things, in my view, should wake us up, but you cannot say with absolute certainty that they are influenced by climate change. You cannot say of any single weather episode with certainty that it is the result of climate change, and therefore you get this tremendous swirl of debate and controversy around it all, which is very, very important in terms of its impact politically and our attempts to cope with it. So it is a very unusual phenomenon which we're struggling to try to master here, and we have to do a lot of innovation, a lot of invention, I think, to cope with it. Now, I don't know what you've been discussing in previous papers, but I feel they've been given here and lectures have been given here, but I feel I must start by saying just a little bit about the science, because the science is crucial and the political implications of the science are crucial. Basically, there are not, as many people think, two positions on climate change and the dangers it holds out for us. There are three. The first is the view of the climate change skeptics. I'm sure everyone here, there may be climate change skeptics in the audience, don't know, but everyone here will be familiar with climate change skepticism. The skeptics either argue that climate change is not happening, or that it was happening for a while and has ground to a halt, or that it is not the result of human intervention into nature, but is the result of, for example, fluctuations in the radiation from the sun or other natural causes. The climate change skeptics, I'm sure everyone here will know, have staged a major comeback over the past 6 months because of the leaked emails at the University of East Anglia, because of various mistakes found in the literature of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Climate Change Committee of the United Nations, and various other attacks that have been mounted on climate change scientists. And I think it's incumbent on everyone to recognize that science does presuppose a skeptical attitude, and therefore it's important to have a skeptical view, or at least look at the science, has to be looked at all the time with a skeptical eye. But as for my position, I spent a good deal of the summer going through the East Anglia emails, the three or four tribunals which the scientists have had to go through, and the other literature that's accumulated in the blogosphere. And although I have to stress, as I did before, I'm not a climatologist and cannot hope to be one, I found nothing in the emails, nothing in those exchanges, which compromised the core scientific findings about science, about climate change, and about its essentially human origins in the recent period. I haven't found anything which would influence me not to still accept that the science is essentially robust, even though future prediction obviously always involves uncertainty. So for me anyway, I feel very distant from the writings of the skeptics. So I had to locate myself in one of the two other positions. The second position is that represented by the IPCC, which, if you like, you could call mainstream scientific opinion. Of course, there are gradations between all these three positions, really. But the vast volumes of research summarized by the IPCC, if I can summarize them very quickly, say basically, yes, climate change is caused by the intrusion of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and by deforestation, those things together. Yes, it is dangerous for our future. It will bring much more extreme forms of weather. And in some parts of the world, these will be very extreme, because if you get an average temperature increase, you get much larger temperature increases in some parts of the world. For example, the Arctic is warming much more quickly than other parts of the world, and these processes will become accentuated. However, the IPCC and orthodox scientific opinion tends to locate these dangers quite a while down the time scale. Tends to say things are going to get really serious by 2040, 2050, and after that period. There is, however, a third position, which I would describe as that of the radicals. The radicals say that climate change is much more dangerous than mainstream scientific opinion argues. They argue it's much more imminent. It is not just a matter of the distant future. And they place a lot of emphasis upon what's come to be called tipping points in climate change. We know, if you look back at natural climate change, you know, the climate's always been fluctuating in the past. You look back at natural climate change in the past, you've sometimes had very abrupt changes in average global temperature over a period of as short as 10 years. Global temperature has fluctuated by 1 degree or 1.5 degrees, which I can assure you is an awful lot in global terms. And they argue the same thing could happen again. Rather than having just progressive development of risk, they say there are a range of situations which could kickstart a quantum jump in global temperatures. For example, in the eastern part of Siberia in Russia, there is a great deal of permafrost. This permafrost has been there for millions of years. It is currently melting. If it melts underneath, there is a lot of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas many times more potent than CO2 in producing the greenhouse effect. The same thing would apply if the ice on Greenland starts to fracture rather than progressively melt. And one of the things that all of us have to keep an eye on for the next 5 years or so is what is actually happening to the Greenland ice. There are two accounts of it. There's the gradualist one, but there's also the more radical one, which suggests the ice doesn't just melt progressively, it splinters, and then large chunks of ice break away. Since it's ice on land, it's more threatening than the melting of the Arctic because it'll elevate the level of the oceans, the sea level across the world. Well, you know, as a layperson committed not just to studying climate change but to political action to try to contain it, I do find myself quite influenced by the radicals. They include people like Jim Hansen of NASA or James Lovelock in a series of books that James Lovelock's written. You know, the guy invented Gaia theory. James Lovelock's recent book, if you want to read it, The Revenge of Gaia, Our Final Warning, is a pretty sobering book, actually. I'd like you to see how this plays out because it's very important politically in thinking of people's consciousness, because the climate change skeptics like Nigel Lawson say we've exaggerated the risks, but because there's uncertainty, and there is uncertainty about the future. It's very important to see that uncertainty cuts both ways. So it's at least, well, to my mind, equally plausible to argue that we've underestimated the risks. And I find the writings of the radicals quite powerful and quite disturbing because, as you know, if there already is a great deal of climate change built into the system, which nothing we do now will do more than just mitigate to some degree, then and if you do get radical phases of change, it is deeply worrying because climate change is irrevocable. I think it's also very significant to notice that compare climate change with say, global poverty. Global poverty, very important, right? We want to try and reduce it. But if we don't reduce it by 2050, it's still pretty terrible, but nothing much else flows from that. In the case of climate change, once the greenhouse gases get into the atmosphere, we know of no way of getting them out again on the large scale. And they're going to be there for centuries. If it's true that, you know, the risks are really serious, as I tend to think they are, it is a very disturbing future for us. And there's a big disconnect for me, really, between the risks, which I think serious risks that we face, and what's happening in everyday life and what's happening politically. Well, what is happening politically? I noticed earlier papers in this conference did go through some of the issues following Copenhagen and so on, so I'll just mention them briefly. At the time of Copenhagen, it did seem as though the world was waking up to the risks and taking them seriously. And, of course, a lot of people expected a great deal from Copenhagen. I have to say, in all due humility, I was not one of them. And in my book on the politics of climate change, I argued that Copenhagen was very unlikely to be successful, very unlikely that you get an agreement between 192 nations with very divergent interests on measures which were sufficiently radical to make any difference. And I think if you look back on Copenhagen, I think you can see it was sunk by the core geopolitical interests in the world, which were very visible before the conference even started, and therefore it was possible to predict what happened. One was the weakness of the United Nations, very difficult to reach key decisions in the United Nations, especially in the Security Council. Second was the dominance of domestic politics over international politics in the United States, which meant that President Obama came to Copenhagen with nothing to offer, really. The third was the paralysis of the EU because the EU lacks leadership, wanted to be a leader in climate change, but no one took any notice of the EU when the final negotiations happened. Fourthly, you had the role of China, still wants to be essentially a sovereign nation primarily, I think, in a world of much greater interdependence, even though the Chinese leadership now certainly accept that climate change is real and dangerous to China and the rest of the world. And finally, you had this massive division between the poorer countries and the richer countries. See, there was never really a scenario, I think, in which you would expect to get sustained agreement. Will the Copenhagen Accord lead to such agreement? I think this is still an open question. It does have some positives because it looks like it might be capable of moving faster than the Kyoto-Copenhagen-style process. Very important thing, as you know, in the Copenhagen Accord was that the big developing countries were in there. Brazil, China, India were all part of the small group that drew up the accord. Something like 180 nations, I think, now have declared that they will submit carbon reduction plans or have already submitted those plans. But I think at the moment we just don't know where it will lead and whether it will really have practical impact. But I think political leaders have a duty to try to push it in a direction whereby it will do and get agreement over at least some key issues. For example, funding to reduce deforestation. It's got some way down the line already. Funding to help the poorer countries, supposed to rise to $100 billion a year, you remember, has already got somewhere down the line. There is some money there. If you can make progress on a cluster of issues like that, it will still be important. But my view is that bilateral connections will also be important, and regional agreements will also be important. For example, in Latin America, between the countries of Latin America, or between China and the US, a key thing for the future of the world really is whether China and the US can work together, not just on climate change and energy, but money in many other areas as well, because you could foresee a fearsome battle between the two for dominance in the 21st century, or you could see a more collaborative relationship, which would be in the interests of everyone in the world. Well, when I'm giving talks, I usually try and, you know, find a few jokes. So I was looking for jokes about climate change, and one of the jokes about climate change is don't seem to be any jokes about climate change because it's too serious an issue. But I did find one, however, which I do apologize if you've heard before. You might have done because there are so few. There are two planets talking to one another, right? And one planet says to the other planet, oh, I don't feel very well. I think I've got Homo sapiens. And the second planet says to the first, well, don't worry, that doesn't last very long. Well, the question is, well, I'm glad not everyone had heard it. The question is, you know, a lot of our capability of coping with climate change will depend upon political action. It will depend upon international collaboration, but it will also depend on what individual nations do. Very important to stress that. The industrial nations must chart a path of carbon reduction for the rest of the world if the rest of the world is going to come on board in a path of overall control of carbon emissions. So what are some of the political issues that one must confront when you look at the challenges that we face? And I'd like to mention four of these. I suppose they're essentially modes of restructuring politics, or how I would see politics being restructured on an international level, but also on a national level too. First of all, I want to argue we must develop a politics of the long term. When you're talking about climate change and energy, which are closely associated with one another, you're talking about long-term investment pattern. We haven't been used to having a politics of the long term, not in the industrial countries, over the period of deregulation. If you look, for example, at energy in the UK, the energy system was deregulated under Mrs. Thatcher, and what happened was the energy companies made virtually no investment for the future. And there was essentially just short-term thinking dominating over long-term thinking, And I think this, you could argue this was true through many aspects of the economy, and also that it's a structural issue in democratic countries where short-term issues tend to take preeminence over longer-term ones. How would we develop a more effective form of long-term thinking in politics and in economics? Well, I want to propose to you that one won't do so by simply going back just to the dominance of the traditional state. We do have to have some kind of planning. We need a return to planning, I think. But that planning can't be the planning of the 1970s, which was kind of cumbersome, ineffective, tried to second-guess the future, and didn't work very well at all. We have to have a much more sophisticated way of anticipating the future, and I don't think this can simply be transferred back into the hands of government and the state. What we're going to need is a more effective partnership between the state and markets, nationally and internationally, so that not just government but also markets work in a long-term interest. We will need many of the things that markets provide. We'll need the flexibility, the innovatory qualities, the capital that markets provide if we're going to, for example, produce the technological innovation needed to cope with climate change. But we don't want to just have free markets of the sense in which we had the past 30 or so years. We have to have new forms of partnership, really, between government and markets. Let me give you an example of that so that concretizes a bit. Because there already is probably a good deal of climate change built into the system, we're going to have to find out how to insure people against the effects of more extreme weather episodes, especially poorer people. If you think of the Caribbean area or Bangladesh, for example, these are areas with already disturbing weather patterns because of their position, location. These will get much worse under the impact of climate change. How are we going to protect poorer people? You will need some form of insurance as well as other kinds of anticipatory protection. Well, we know from Hurricane Katrina that even the richest state in the world can't provide more than just basic insurance to cover damage. Not much of the damage which was created, especially for poorer people, was actually picked up by the state in the United States, either the local state or the federal state, after Hurricane Katrina. So what that means is that the private insurance industry is going to have a big role in this. And we have to think how you can harness the insurance industry to provide long-term protection, especially for people who don't have much money. There are some very interesting innovations going on in this area, led by the German insurance company Allianz and one or two other companies, which are developing kind of partnership between the insurance companies, government, and poorer people. In Bangladesh, for example, the Allianz have developed long-term 10, 15, 20-year bonds, as they have in the Caribbean area. They're based on a kind of fusion between high-tech prediction of weather, because with modern satellites, we can predict weather patterns, weather paths, much more effectively than even 5 or so years ago. What causes damage doesn't depend so much on the intensity of a storm as on the path the storm follows. If we can predict the path, we can analyze risk more effectively and therefore predict what will happen, what damage will be caused more effectively. And very interestingly, they've combined that with very low-tech forms of protection, the use of local kinship groups. In Bangladesh, they've invented floating gardens, which means that you can carry on agriculture even when you have a flood. Floating gardens have actually been copied in other parts of the world since then. And you've got a kind of fusion of high-tech and low-tech. Same thing's happening in Rwanda. And I think it's a very interesting form of development, and it's the kind of innovation which I would like to see for the future. And it could be generalized to many other areas where we have to look for similar things. So first of all, I think we need to explore the nature of long-term political collaboration, sort of regionally, nationally, globally. We need to be innovative in order to do so. and we need somehow to sort out the beneficent aspects of markets from their noxious ones in order to be able to utilize them in conjunction with government to try to deal with some of core global problems. Of course, there are many different combinations of these two depending on circumstance. Second, I feel we have to work very strongly to try to contain political polarization around climate change. To me, well, I don't think one can overstress the importance of the fact that climate change is not a left-right issue. I see no sense in which it is intrinsically a left-right issue, climate change. It's an issue which concerns all of us, where we're all necessarily facing the same dangers, and therefore it seems to me it transcends left-right divisions. Now, in some countries, quite a few countries, it has been possible to create cross-party collaboration, which is what we should be looking for, to get sustained long-term policy. And this has actually happened here so far. I've spoken in several debates on climate change bill, energy bill, when it went through the House of Lords. And there was a lot of agreement between the three parties. And the bill actually got radicalized when it went through Parliament rather than the reverse. However, you also at the same time see a disturbing creeping political polarization around climate change between left and right. And especially those on the far right tend to see climate change as a hoax, or tend certainly to be climate change skeptics. And I tend to think this is growing rather than declining. The place, unfortunately, where it's most advanced is the United States. And that is a very serious issue, I think, for the future of the world in respect of climate change and energy policy too. In the United States, climate change has been largely polarized between left and right, both in a technical sense of Democrats and Republicans, but also in a more extreme sense of there are many right-wing groups in the United States who even threaten violence against climate change scientists and so forth. Quite disturbing political situation. The outcome of that is that it has done what I mentioned earlier. It's kind of crippled President Obama's capability to function as a world leader in respect of reorienting the United States to try to reduce American emissions. So I think, you know, we have to avoid this as far as possible in other places. Because in the United States, it's already a serious, serious issue, which is not a domestic issue simply. It concerns all of us because no effective climate change legislation has gone through Congress, and it may never go through Congress now. At the same time, the United States, with 4% of the world's population, producing 25% of the world's emissions. Seems to me the Americans are pretty hypocritical about BP. I mean, I'm not at all in favor of the deep drilling that BP was doing, which seems to me a kind of outer edge of madness of our civilization, really. But you can see how it's driven by American demand. Because in the United States, no politician has had the courage to even put relatively minor taxes on gasoline, with a consequence that Americans use twice as much energy in their vehicle transport as we do in the European Union. The only reason for that is the higher taxes on fuel in the European Union. They clearly should have much higher taxes on the use of fuel in the United States, but at the moment it seems to be a political non-starter. How can we try and keep political divisions out of the climate change arena? I do feel that the political left, to which I belong, does have a responsibility in this. Because if those on the left go around saying green is the new red, I think that inherently antagonizes people on the political right. And I don't think it's true, because I think climate change is a different issue from the old red versus blue type issue. So I think both sides of the political spectrum have a responsibility. And I think the civil service in any country also has a responsibility to sustaining long-term policy on the back of changes in government which occur. We've got a lot of evidence showing that a robust civil service can be very important in driving long-term policy. Anyway, quite a cluster of issues, really, around all of that. Thirdly, I think in trying to address the issue of climate change, it's not enough just to try to frighten people in terms of avoiding catastrophe. I do hope that the extreme weather events that happened this year do make an impact on people's consciousness, because I think they're a warning sign for the future. I mean, in Russia, for example, you had temperatures higher than ever been previously recorded. As you probably know, a large proportion of the Russian grain output was lost. That's having a big impact on the developing countries because grain prices are shooting up and could produce starvation in some of those countries. So the consequences in Pakistan, you had 20 million people displaced. You know, I think it is possible to suppose that this might help wake up global consciousness to the problems of climate change. But I think for most ordinary everyday actors, it doesn't work that way, partly because we're surrounded by potential catastrophes in their eyes. You have, for example, you had avian flu, then you had swine flu, God, you had a financial crisis, and all these things, and then you have movies about catastrophes in the future. Quite hard for an ordinary member of the public to insert climate change as a real potential catastrophe into that discourse, I think. So I would argue, and I'm sure you've talked about this in previous parts of this discussion, that we need a politics of hope around climate change, and we need a positive form of politics about what a low-carbon economy and society would look like locally, nationally, and globally. I don't know if you know them, but two quite well-known American environmentalists who were called Nordhaus and Schellinger wrote this book called The Death of Environmentalism, in which they said Martin Luther King wouldn't have got anywhere if he said, "I've got a nightmare. We've got to have a dream for the future." And I think this is true. So I think, therefore, politically, we have to explore the contours of a low-carbon economy and a low-carbon society. We have to show that the changes involved will not all involve costs, but many of them will involve benefits. We have to show that you can produce a better form of society by converging a politics of climate change and energy with other political aspirations. We have to show that you can chart an alternative path of development. I think this is crucial for countries like China and India, but it's also very important for our industrial civilization in the West. I think anyone who studies China and India will see that there cannot be a long period during which they simply recapitulate the paths of development of the West, because it seems to be too destructive in terms of local environmental consequences as well as in terms of its impact on climate change. You have to find an alternative path. And I think it's quite easy to see that it can overlap with other political objectives. For example, energy security is going to be a massive issue in the 21st century. And we know that many of the technologies which will reduce carbon increase your energy security. This is true of nuclear energy, controversial though it is, but also all forms of renewable energy. If you go, I don't know if you, well, I'm sure everyone would have read the newspapers and read this traffic jam that happened in China that, you know, stretched 100 miles or something on the highway from Beijing to Tibet, something like 100-mile traffic jam. Well, I mean, it's not too difficult to see a convergence of concern about the ludicrous nature of this with an attempt to produce a kind of effective low-carbon politics, because the car used to be an instrument of mobility and freedom. What mobility and freedom is there if you're stuck in 100-mile traffic jam? It's in the interests of Chinese government political leaders to rethink the nature of cities, to rethink the nature of the car, to try and jump ahead of the path of development which we followed in the West. If you have a city in which there is a fair amount of social solidarity between people, mutual support, local businesses, is it wise necessarily to build a supermarket outside of the city centre which will destroy those features? Not necessarily so. It's quite easy to see, through example, that you could have more effective models of development, and probably you must have at a certain point, which would have a convergence between wider political objectives than the objective of limiting carbon emissions and reducing, or at least restricting, climate change. And I think in the industrial countries too, we've also got to be looking for such convergences in the future. Many of them, I feel, will be bottom-up initiatives rather than top-down initiatives. And I think, you know, I'm sure you've discussed this, but this is really interesting in relation, for example, to the United States or a country like India, because in both India and the US, you've got very weak federal policy on climate change. But they're both very diverse countries. You've got an amazing amount of stuff going on locally, in cities, and in states in the US, which is very progressive. And I think those things will ultimately have an impact at a wider level. You have numerous organizations of cities, for example, in the US, which are part of international organizations of cities, all have got plans to limit their carbon emissions. You've got all sorts of initiatives at the lower levels, the United States, around technology, which could have a massive impact for the future. But what interested me, having had quite a lot of interaction with Indian leaders over the last little while, is how much the same thing is true in India. You do have an awful lot going on at a local level. You have massive concern with sustainability. You have many people working on these issues, both in business and in local government. So the appearance is not the reality. There is an awful lot going on which we can hope to harness and which I believe will make an impact, although whether it will make an impact in time is an imponderable thing. Finally and fourthly, I want to argue that we need a return to a certain utopian element in politics. Utopia has kind of disappeared from our political system, but I don't think this is right and proper. What we need if we're going to seriously regulate climate change is an awful lot of innovation. A lot of it has to be social, political, and economic, not just technological innovation, in my opinion. I think social, economic, political innovation like to be more important, actually, than technological innovation. But to do such a thing, we need to harness the power of the imagination, and we need to think of a world different from the one which we're living in at present. We need to look on the other side of industrial civilization. I think the facts of the matter are pretty plain. We are living in an unsustainable civilization. Industrial civilization, as it has become globalized, is unsustainable. And we have so much material on that. Therefore, we have to discover something on the other side, which will look different, but hopefully will still allow economic development, will still allow some of the fruits that industrial civilization has brought us, but allow us to at least control the damage that it's wreaking on the planet. I'd like to propose an attitude of what I call utopian realism. Utopian realism sounds contradictory, but I don't think it is. I think we'll need a dash of utopianism to think how we can change the world, but we'll need a strong dash of realism because climate change, as I've stressed all the way through, is an issue which we can't put off. It is an issue of a cumulative nature. We don't know how to get the emissions out of the air once they're there. Therefore, we must try and contain it early on as far as we can. We must take action against it. There must be a realistic path of doing that, which is conjoined with a utopian element. Let me again give you an example, maybe continuing on the one I mentioned before. For example, the role of the car in our civilization. If you look at the climate change plan of the government, as a plan, you know, to reduce emissions by 20% by 2020 in this country over 1990 levels, one of the ways they're going to try and do it is through the introduction of electric cars. Now, electric cars may be important, especially if you can source the electricity from renewable influences. It could be important in reducing emissions. But I think if you simply say we're going to have the same system of transport, have the same role of the car, we're going to multiply cars on our roads, it's just that 20% of them be electric, that is just a failure of the imagination. We have to ask what is on the other side of the car, I think. And there's a very good book about this by a colleague of mine called John Urry, URRY, John Urry, U-R-R-Y, if anyone's interested, called Beyond the Car, which argues that there are all sorts of experiments going on at the moment which show what a likely future will be for the car. There's also a very interesting book called Reinventing the Automobile by the MIT research lab, Reinventing the Automobile. Both have similar kinds of arguments. They say if you look at experiments that are going on in various cities around the world, you can see that there is a movement towards transcending the public-private division in transport. There is a move towards using smart cars, towards people not necessarily owning the cars they use, towards integrating the use of the car, the primarily electric cars, with pedestrianizing different areas, with primacy of the cyclist and so forth. And you have some cities which have got an awful long way down the line. John Urry quotes some cities that have reduced their carbon emissions by 50% over what it was some 10 years before, and have developed integrated, starting to develop integrated transport systems. The MIT study argues that this will be the future of the car generically. They even say the car is going to look different. It's driven at the moment in a very traditional way, Henry Ford type way, engine at the front, kind of drivetrain fueled by gasoline. The emergent car, which they've already designed, already in practice, quite different, doesn't necessarily have a drivetrain at all, doesn't necessarily have a steering wheel at all, looks quite different than the existing car, might even break the macho image of motor cars. Well, you know, the motor car is a serious agent of death. More people have died in vehicle accidents in the 20th century than have died in all the wars in the 20th century. More than 1 million people are killed worldwide in vehicle accidents. We already have the technology which can allow the reduction of accidents in principle to zero, more or less zero, by using information tracking systems. And the MIT study says you're going to have like a mobility internet, where vehicles will be linked to one another. A lot of them will be driverless. You get radically improved safety and so forth. Well, it sounds utopian, and to some extent it is utopian, but to my mind it's also realistic. And I think we have to be thinking along those lines in many areas of our lives if we're really going to cope with the issue of climate change. Well, I'll leave you with another little story, if you don't mind. I used to be the head of the LSE, as Robert mentioned, and one of the founders of the LSE was George Bernard Shaw, right? He was a playwright. You've heard of him, George Bernard Shaw. And he had this kind of acerbic relationship with Winston Churchill, George Bernard Shaw did, and Winston Churchill once sent a note to George Bernard Shaw once sent a note to Winston Churchill saying, "Dear Winston, here is a ticket to the first night of my new play. Please bring a friend, always assuming you have a friend." And Winston Churchill wrote back saying, "Dear Bernard, thanks for your invitation. I'm sorry I can't make the first night. Please send me a ticket for the second night, always assuming there is a second night." The point of that little story is there is no second night for us in respect of climate change. That is, there are no second chances. And unless we do manage to instill, as it were, a message of green hope that has some purchase, the dangers that face us are truly, in my mind, serious and without precedent. And we're condemning our children to a very, very uncertain and dangerous future if we don't take our chance now as we stand. Thank you very much for your attention.